Welcome to Words Matter. I'm Elise Jordan along with Steve Schmidt. Our goal is to promote objective reality. As a wise man once said, everyone is entitled to their own opinion, not their own facts. Words have power, and words have consequences.
The recounts have begun in the races for Florida governor and U.S. senator, and the race for governor of Georgia, as well as the U.S. Senate race in Arizona, still hang in the balance. Once again, proving the wisdom of Yogi Berra, it ain't over till it's over. But Steve, let's set the table. What happened on Election Day?
Democrats won is what happened on Election Day. Democratic Party had a strategic objective. On the morning of Election Day, Washington was run by the Republicans. They controlled effectively all three branches of government with conservative majorities on the Supreme Court, both houses of Congress, and the executive branch. The day after the election, government is divided. That was the Democratic Party's strategic objective. They obtained their objective. They also picked up crucial governor seats across the country, but very significantly in these states: Nevada, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan. These are all states that Donald Trump won. Some of those states, like Wisconsin and Michigan, had Republican governors. They now have Democratic governors. There were massive victories down the state legislative level. You saw more women elected than in, I believe, almost any election in American history. You saw a retrenchment of the geographical lines of American politics in that the Republican Party, Trumpism, was repudiated from urban America, from suburban America. And though Republicans were able to defend their terrain, their turf, they defended it as if it was a fighting retreat, moving back further into the redoubt, further into rural America, and heralding that they were able to win in North Dakota, for example, as it was a great victory, I think belies the fact of the demographics in the Republican Party. And structurally, when you look at the election, it spells ultimately in time a death knell to all of this, because when you look at the geographies and you look at the demographics, Republicans have put themselves into a demographic prison where their destiny is shaped by the reality that the rural populations of America are shrinking, they are aging, they are not being reconstituted, and the growth is in the other parts of the country. So Democrats have subpoena power. They have an ability to exercise their constitutional authority of checks and balances as the framers designed our system, which is the oldest constitutional republic in the world. So this was a very significant victory, but it speaks to a defeatism at some level inside the Democratic Party, because they look at races where emotionally they had become attached to Beto O'Rourke or Stacey Abrams or Andrew Gillum.
So was this an issue of the expectations game? Did the Democrats win the day but lost the expectation game? Because I, just to your point, I spend a lot of time on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. I'm a New Yorker. And there were people, they weren't reflecting what you said today about the victory.
When you look at what party's on the advance and what party's on the retreat, imagine a scenario where the Republican for U.S. Senate had been within 3 points in California, because that's what happened in Texas. Or imagine that you had states like New York, where a Republican was knocking on the door, or a mega state like New Jersey, where a Republican was knocking on the door, or states like Oregon or Washington State, where Republicans contested and very nearly won. The reality is Democrats put the state of Georgia, the state of Texas, into play. And Florida is always a difficult assignment for Democrats, but there are lessons to be learned. Part of the lesson is the ability to invigorate and excite a base. And Democrats will have to look as they get deeper into the returns. Are there things, are there lessons, are there things that could have been done in this race that would have put them over the top? But the reality is this election isn't defined by the seats they lost. It should be judged by the power they've gained. And for the first time in his life, Donald Trump will have a check on him. He'll have oversight on him. And that's why. Less than 24 hours after the results, we saw literally the most illiberal news conference in American history, certainly in an era where the words of a president were able to be heard by radio or phonograph or on television. And what Donald Trump said today is, I am not to be criticized. That's fake news. And anyone who purveys in fake news is thus an enemy of the people. He said, I'm not to be investigated. And he fired Jeff Sessions and appointed somebody who was quite clear about their lack of belief in the Mueller investigation.
Yeah, and look, and we're gonna get to that because that's more of the what happens next. But in terms of what happened, Elise, I have to say you deserve some credit here because over the weekend you and I had talked about the things that you had been hearing on the campaign trail, the focus groups you'd done, and you said to me, it feels like it could be closer to a blue splash than a true wave. Talk about the hardening of those lines that Steve mentioned in those rural areas, in those sort of crossovers, rural to suburban areas, those places you did focus groups with Lord Ashcroft. Just talk a little bit about what you saw and what you heard and then what happened on election night.
Well, I think Steve is right that Democrats have a lot to be excited about when it comes to the House and some of the districts that flipped and turned blue that have been longtime Republican strongholds. I'm far more concerned when it comes to what I think is the deepening political segregation of our country within this two-party system. And especially you look at how that plays out with the Senate and how that's going to play out in the months and years to come as it regards Donald Trump and keeping a check on Donald Trump.
As the battle lines were drawn, so to speak, for 2020 on the front lines of the cold civil war that Donald Trump has stoked, this division line between white rural America and the rest of the country. What Trump has done is completely reinvent the Republican Party in a span of about 3 years. And he has made it a blood and soil nationalist party. What he has laid out is a vision where we are disagreeable or warring tribes sharing a geographical space, as opposed to one people from all over the world who are faithful to the most important and profound idea ever put to paper by the mind of man, that we are all created equal, endowed by a creator with certain liberties, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The American nation is unique because it is a nation founded on the power of an idea. What Donald Trump has put forward is quite the opposite. In fact, what he said, America is a place where people look a certain way, meaning white. And he has stoked and incited and brought to the surface all the ugliest toxins, all the most virulent pathologies of America's history, things that the country we had thought had moved beyond. And we have to be honest about the reality that his incitement campaign worked in large parts of the country. Now, you can look at the Republicans who lost. The lesson for the Republicans who remain in Congress, who remain in the United States Senate, will be this. If the people who had lost embrace the incitement strategy, they would have won. That the borderline, if you will, between victory and defeat is the capacity, willingness, and toughness to incite and antagonize and to demagogue on racial lines. And we should understand something that occurred in this election, and we should dwell very deeply on it. What happened in the last 2 weeks? We saw the largest mass assassination plot in American history. And that was attempted by a political fanatic who had devoted himself to Donald Trump as a faithful and obedient member of a cult of personality. And he decided one day that riding around in the van wasn't enough, that he was going to be a soldier in the army in the service of Trump and Trumpism. His enemies were the president's enemies.
I think that's a good point. Elise, you talked to some of those people in those focus groups who those messages that Steve's talking about were reaching, those same people who are on the other end of that $1 billion. And talk about a little bit just they love him. They agree with him. It worked, to Steve's point. It worked.
Well, and to start this conversation, I want to preface it with, over the last 2 years, we start all of our focus groups by asking people how they consume their news media. And usually people won't admit, they don't want to admit if they get it off of Facebook or Twitter, but it's painfully obvious that the death of the local newspaper and of local news has created this huge vacuum that Fox News has essentially filled. And InfoWars and other far right outlets that they are pandering to fear and just parading blatantly false information in front of the consumer. And that's what, when that is your news diet, you start to go rotten a little bit on the inside.
So, and it's amazing to me, and we people talked about it, but they didn't harp on it because so much was going on. But seeing Sean Hannity standing behind a podium with the seal of the President of the United States in front of him, speaking at a rally and being cheered as if he's a member of the campaign, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, I've never seen a press secretary go to a rally. Talk about, I mean, it's just, it's extraordinary. It's unbelievable.
Well, it's the propagandists, which would not be unfamiliar in an authoritarian society where the Minister of Information, propaganda minister, may speak, may be the person who focuses the adulation, the energies, the devotions of the crowd. Trump is, for millions of Americans, the golden calf, a false idol, if you will. But they are obedient and they are faithful. And so when Donald Trump says at the news conference after the election, "I am a great moral leader." Well, of course, that's a joke. It's a farce. Ludicrous. What's dangerous is that tens and tens and tens of millions of Americans, despite all evidence to the contrary, despite the ludicrousness of the statement, accept it because they are required to be a member of good standing inside conservatism, inside their tribe. The singular requirement of conservatism at this hour is obedience. That was the plain message of Donald Trump's castigation of each and every member who did not fully embrace him. And he was very specific about the use of that term, embrace. They did not show obedience. And they did not show deference. And thus, they were ostracized. And thus, they were castigated and they lost. But the danger is the suspension of disbelief, the ability to look at a lie and be unable to distinguish it from reality. That in the politics that we all grew up in, that a Republican candidate may be disingenuous or a Democratic candidate disingenuous around the concept of a middle-class tax cut should make no one fall out of their chair. But in this case, well, trust me, if you have the ability to look in the camera and lie about a made-up invasion, right, anything goes.
And to deploy American men and women who are your main responsibility as commander-in-chief, your biggest responsibility is that decision to send men and women into combat. And if you will do that for political purposes, you'll do anything.
And so when you look about the ability for the Democrats to exercise oversight, to fulfill their Article I constitutional duty and responsibilities, to oversight the executive branch, profoundly stupid as a tactic is the first thing, even before we know the results of West Coast races, there's leaks out of Democratic leadership that they're going to use subpoena power to get Donald Trump's taxes. How about this? How about oversight hearings looking at the use and abuse of the United States military in a political stunt? Get every document, subpoena the secretary, get the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Every unit has orders. Those things are all written. Those things are down. There's a reason. There's a rationale. And like you said, there's a paper trail. Much more interesting and much more understandable and much more important.
Do it with the children who are still in baby cages down on the border. There's still hundreds of children who have been permanently orphaned because of this administration.
And so the Democrats have a wide field upon which to roam, doing oversight, doing their duty, where the American people, I believe, will respond rather positively to it, as opposed to immediately amping up retributionally the next cycle of revenge in the cold civil war in the country.
Well, and so, Steve, you gave me a good segue into discussion of what I found to be most profoundly disturbing on this most recent cross-country tour listening to American voters, how Donald Trump's rhetoric and the violence that he incites is being blamed on the media for reporting what he says. The media, plenty of Trump supporters argue, should censor what they report, not tell the truth, because they need to exercise judgment because the commander-in-chief can't. This is something that I heard very frequently, and it's very profoundly disturbing, the implications that the media has any responsibility except to tell the truth.
We have an enormous civics crisis in this country, and that's evidenced by what we've seen play out here over the last weeks of this campaign, but on the day after the election. And so first off, the idea in this country is that the First Amendment guarantees freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of religion. This is foundational to the concept of American liberty, of American Republican, small r, democracy. It is fundamental to liberalism, small l, pluralism, freedom, unrestricted speech. The idea that in a country founded on these core concepts, that you have tens and tens of millions of Americans who have given up, lost touch with, faith with the concept of the freedom of speech, that freedom of speech should be restricted, that it should be contained, that it should be at the discretion for the purposes of the favor of the leader.
That you should protect the powerful instead of being an advocate for the powerless.
The purpose of the First Amendment in form and function and of a free press is to afflict the powerful, not to comfort them. And that all of our political philosophers, all of our great defenders of American liberty, all of our presidents, and you can find the quotes by JFK, by Ronald Reagan, all of whom understood that the gateway to tyranny is the assault on the freedom of the press, on freedom of the speech. It's deeply, deeply disturbing. And let's look at the news conference today on the question of investigation and oversight. Donald Trump was quite clear. What he said was that if I were to be investigated, if subpoenas were issued, if Congress exercises its Article I constitutional duty and does oversight of the executive branch, well, there's a little thing called the U.S. Senate, and we'll investigate them. The United States Senate is the upper house of a co-equal branch of government. It's an Article I branch of government. The separation of powers divide American government into three co-equal branches: a judicial branch headed by the Supreme Court, the executive branch, where we find the President of the United States, and the legislative branch. For the first time in American history, what we saw was an American president talking about what used to be called the world's greatest deliberative body turned into a political weapon, a cudgel, to strike at his political opposition. What he said was, I will use, the president will direct the United States Senate to investigate, in retaliation, an abuse of power of epic dimensions. I will use the United States Senate to strike down, to investigate my political opponents, should the majority party in the House of Representatives do its constitutional duty and conduct oversight of my administration, there has never in the history of this country ever been an occasion where an American president has stood before any group, any audience at any time ever from George Washington on and delivered such an illiberal, autocratic in sentiment series of remarks.
Elise, there's another right, and Steve talks about the freedom of speech, the freedom of the press. There's another fundamental right that I know you were paying particular attention to, and that's the right to vote.
I think that Democrats and those of us who are never Trumpers, I think that there's a very big tactical mistake being made by framing the argument against Donald Trump strictly in moralistic terms. I think that next phase, going forward, there should be an emphasis on the complete incompetency of the administration, because some of their intent is definitely evil, but I think you start to strip away at it by just showing how completely inept they are. And that's why looking at what happened in Georgia, it really hit me very deeply and personally and painfully, having grown up in the Deep South and looking at the trouble that people had going to exercise their basic right as a citizen to have a say in their democratic government, and looking at the sheer ineptitude of the government of Georgia in exercising that election.
But was it ineptitude, or was it, as a senator I once worked for, called benign neglect?
The first, if it was conscious voter suppression, I think it's far worse. The second, however, if you are a Republican who is campaigning on your ability to get shit done, I think is pretty bad, too. And that hits your bottom line of your reason for being, or your reason that you should actually be governing. So I think that we need to focus on attacking what they cannot do, which is actually exercise their jobs. The other point that came into really clear focus over the last 3 weeks for me was just how divided the country is in terms of you're either pure or evil. You're either in part of the tribe, as Steve has talked to spoken about, or you are someone that must be fought and protested at every step of the way. And this tweet my brother sent to me the morning of the election from a local state rep: anyone who votes Dem in 18 is either ignorant or evil. There's no excuse for supporting killing babies or open borders. If that offends you, not Y-O-U, you, I'll pray for you, but I won't apologize. Switch parties and vote Rep, or continue to support the destruction of our nation and vote socialist Dem. These are not terms that you can argue on in terms of partisan ideology, in terms of policy position, in terms of
tax rates.
Exactly. This is, you should be sent to the gulag, or you can come and hang out at our church. And there's not really an in-between there. And if people can't talk about basic differences, then this is indeed not just a cold civil war. I'm worried it's escalating into something even more intense.
Well, it's a big country with a lot of cultural differences, and I grew up in the state of New Jersey, and the only appropriate response I could think to give to that email would be to tell that state rep to go fuck himself. Because in the United States of America, right, in the United States of America, we get to have dissenting opinions. Right. And inherently, American virtue is defiance. The country was begat in an act of defiance, in an act of rebellion. And the idea, the arrogance to think that you are completely right, that there can be no positive motive, that there could be no goodwill, that there could be no good idea, no approach. I'll give you an example of the type of arrogance there. I'm sure he was lock, stock, and barrel in favor of the Iraq war back in the day. Now, as somebody who was supportive in 2003 and thought it made all the sense in the world, looking back, I think I have to be open enough to say that the people who opposed it, who predicted the disaster, they were right. And I was wrong.
Absolutely. All three of us.
And show humility.
And so
learn from your mistakes.
It's the total absence of humility, but the idea that there's no room for a dissenting opinion. Do you really want to live in a country where there's no room for a dissenting opinion. And so we miss a big point in the debate that's going on in this era when we say, well, Donald Trump could never take away a broadcast license, or you could never lock up somebody for disagreeing with you over a matter of politics. Wrong question. It's not could they today, it's if they could, would they? And does anybody have any doubt that if Donald Trump could strip away CNN's broadcast license, that he would? That if you speak out against Donald Trump, that enormous sections of his base would say that that should be illegal and you should be jailed? That if you have the gall to say that the child separation policy is immoral, that you should go to prison? That's what's creeping into American politics, and it's on both sides.
There has to be some middle ground in both of these debates where both sides don't immediately take what they disagree with and brandish the other person as pure evil.
And again, speaking to the civics apocalypse we stand on the edge of, you know, one of the things that Arnold Schwarzenegger's doing, you know, my old boss, is involved in all these redistricting initiatives around the country trying to end and reform the practice of gerrymandering. So when we look at the popular vote in this election, we see the enormous advantage that Democrats had. They picked up 30 seats when the Republicans had about the same generic advantage back in the wave election, that they picked up 62 seats in 2014, double the amount the Democrats did. And so I get the gerrymandering piece. But a lot of people were saying, well, it's totally unfair that each state has two senators. The lack of understanding about the country's core freedoms and liberties, its constitutional system, its small r Republican system, what the United States is, how it was conceived, how it functions, how it operates, how co-equal branches of government check each other. This is the most ingenious form of government ever designed by man.
I want to talk about a few of the bright spots before we wrap up this portion, which is people like Stacey Abrams in Georgia and Beto O'Rourke and Andrew Gillum. Both, Elise, why don't you start?
I think it's incredible and it's inspiring and it's heartening that these young, dynamic leaders push forward, that they were serious contenders, that they did it with their dignity and their honor intact, and they did it in a way that I personally admired, and I would have voted for them even though I'm a libertarian. I was formerly a Republican, as we all know, but I believe that the morals that they represented, that it's more important than the status quo of a tax cut that doesn't really help me, even if, you know, I can say I sincerely support it, but let's be honest, that tax cut doesn't help me at all. So yes, on that level, I found it very inspiring. I'm glad these young new leaders are going to continue to be forces in our republic over the years and decades to come. That said, these candidates represent the existential crisis that the Democrats face in choosing who they want to be the leaders of their party and choosing leaders that are going to be palatable to more than a primary base of your voters. And you look at Texas, and Beto O'Rourke was so inspiring and did so incredibly well and got so close to beating Ted Cruz that I certainly hesitate to criticize him, but I do think if he had moderated some of his policy issues, he could have appealed to that 40% of Texans who are more moderate but aren't super liberal, the 20% that he completely hit, but another 40% that he totally alienated, the ultra-conservative who came out for Ted Cruz. So I think that it's very important that Democrats be mindful of how they can pursue their policy agenda while actually winning.
Steve, talk about Beto for a second, because I have to say, as somebody who's been a Beto fan, and I don't know in this day and age if you have a candidate named Robert Francis O'Rourke, and he campaigned the way he did, and he caused the excitement. When they brought the fog machine out for the concession speech, I said to myself, well, is this what politics has become? And sort of to Elise's point, not that we like to Monday morning quarterback somebody who in that state came so close, but talk a little bit about Beto now, today, yesterday, today, and maybe tomorrow.
You get to be a superhero in America only on the basis of how good your nemesis is. And he had a really good nemesis in Ted Cruz, one of the most pernicious forces in American politics, someone who oozes inauthenticity and contrivance, really a vandal in our political system, comes to Washington, an utterly pernicious force. When you look back on the government shutdown, it's really almost a vandal. Takes off immediately out of the state to run for president. During the presidential campaign, you see him denouncing President Trump, then becoming a lackey to President Trump, watching Donald Trump attack his father and his wife, and then him becoming a bootlicker to Donald Trump.
Ted Cruz was willing to wear a diaper so that he could filibuster and stand up for that many hours. That says it all.
And so Beto O'Rourke was it about that. He raised incredible amounts of money. There's lots of lessons to be learned. But let's look at the Florida race.
Yeah.
So how many Floridians used to live in New York and New Jersey and escaped to Florida, a zero income tax state, with a booming economy, with a generation of Republican governors to thank for it, who said, I didn't move here for this to become a high-tax state. How many Venezuelans and Cubans in the underperforming Miami-Dade County, as Chuck Todd pointed out, reacted to the unrebutted charge of socialism? If you're a Venezuelan, you probably have a pretty strong view of the evils of socialism.
Why did he not rebut the socialism? Was it because of a Democratic base? Was it because of belief? Was it a political tactic? Because I agree with you, and I think one of the lessons in our lifetime, Steve, and Elise's as well, but was the fact that the Clinton 92 campaign let no shot go unanswered. And so, why did he not? Because is socialism, you don't want to denounce that because that's a wing of the party you need? Is it because you're looking to a nomination?
I think that, unfortunately, the hurdle of race is bigger than we want to acknowledge. The FBI tried to entrap him with a Hamilton ticket.
He ran an incredible race. And I want to be clear about that. So did Beto O'Rourke. The point is, though, when you're talking about winning these races, as a Democrat running for governor of Florida, Democrat running for senator in Texas, it's like neurosurgery. The level of precision required is absolute. And so are there lessons to be learned? Both Stacey Abrams, Andrew Gillum, and Beto O'Rourke are responsible for carrying Democratic members of Congress over the line. Beto O'Rourke has breathed life into the Democratic Party in Texas. And he has prefaced the hour that will come when a Democrat does win in Texas. And for sure, if he decides to be a presidential candidate, being a person who raised more money in the history of America, including presidential nominations, unless your name was Clinton or Obama, he's a serious national figure. The Stacey Abrams race is a little bit different than both the Gillum race and the O'Rourke race. Stacey Abrams' race is disturbing. You have a corrupt Secretary of State who abused his power. You have all manner of anomalies breaking out from power cords, lines, people walking off of voting lines. And you have to look at this from a Georgia perspective. Georgia is neither Mississippi or Alabama with respect. Georgia's a megastate. It's one of the most important states in the country from a port of entry perspective, the largest airports in the world, a place where Hollywood does immense productions. It's a place with NFL teams and NBA teams and Major League Baseball teams, industries. It's a center of commerce and banking, and not for nothing. Georgia's economic growth and development began back in the 70s, where it became the capital of what was branded the New South. But you look at the bunch of bullshit that went on around this election down there, looks a lot like the Old South to me. And so when you look at...
Or a third world country.
When you look at all of corporate America's response, for example, on some of the anti-LGBT laws that were passed, where companies said, in the last couple of years. For example, the NFL with regard to the Super Bowl in Arizona, when Arizona was in a pass a really a legal discrimination bill targeting gay people, and said, we're just not going to be in business with you if you do that. And you saw how quickly states put down the discrimination because of the amount of money, the amount of economics they would lose. So companies have tremendous economic power and influence in states. And the idea that you're going to have a mega state and you're going to have the operations of as many companies, as many productions, as much business, as much tourism, as much convention business, it goes on in the state of Georgia, where there is not a fair voting process, where there is disenfranchisement of the type that we saw in 2018. This is a big deal what went on down there. This is a tainted race. This is an election that you look out that any fair reading of it, you have to question its legitimacy. And she is 100% correct in her assessment not to concede this race. And we'll see if there's enough vote share to trigger the automatic recount. But what went on there? If you had a functioning civil rights division inside the Justice Department, a state like Georgia, looking at Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, this is something that's worthy of discussion and investigation and something that we should not stop talking about.
Well, and my blood pressure rises talking about it, thinking of all of the hollow bullshit that we've spewed around the world talking about protecting and preserving free and fair elections. And then we're going to tolerate that happening on our own soil. It's disgraceful. It shouldn't be stood for. We would never tolerate if we were in a country as an election monitor, if an elected official was conveniently overseeing their own election.
Well, and to your point, Elise, look, I think that one of the things that happened during that campaign, I've never been a huge fan of President Jimmy Carter, but I think he's probably one of our greatest former presidents, but I've never agreed with him on a lot of things. But I will tell you, that letter that he wrote to Kemp, to telling him to resign, talking about the exact point, Elise, that you just made, that he'd observed
Karen Handel resigned when she ran for governor.
Absolutely.
She was Secretary of State. She had no problem resigning.
And making those same comparisons you just did to the unfair elections that he'd witnessed as an election observer around the world. And that's happening in the United States of America in 2018. To both your points, it's disgraceful. And I think you're right, Steve. I think that a corporate effort, a private sector effort, a Hollywood effort, for lack of a better way of putting it, the entertainment industry, that's the way to go.
And I just want to speculate that I think it's one that will appeal to the men and women of Georgia. I look at Mississippi and how Mississippians are now rejecting the state flag because it hurts our economic self-interest. And that's an argument that I know the left, it's not necessarily where they want to go with it because they would rather pursue the obvious race argument. But you also have to tell people how it affects their own self-interest. And that's something that this entire election cycle, Democrats just quite frankly didn't do very well. Men and women aren't going to change their vote because of what Donald Trump is saying. They're going to affect it because it changes their self-interest.
When you look back at American history, and I think this race bears mentioning also, and it's the good news that all Americans of goodwill can celebrate, which is the defeat of the racist whack job, Kris Kobach. And
absolutely.
Thank God that he might be appointed AG, Steve.
in Kansas. And, well, he should not be confirmable as Attorney General of the United States. And I would be shocked if he was able to move through successfully the nominating process, given the small majority there. But when you look at that Kansas race, what you saw was really the drawing of a boundary, an out of bounds. And Kansas is such an interesting state. Historically, you look at the fault lines, we're talking about Civil War. It was the state, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, that, you know, put the country into its final turn before we had Civil War. It was the fault line between North and South, Bloody Kansas, and a long history of division between the moderate wing of the Kansas Republican Party and a more extreme and conservative one. You also see in Kansas the hollowing out and small-c corruption of the conservative intellectual project. You look, for example, at the Laffer curve and supply-side economics and the idea that which I've never understood Democrats who are in faithful opposition to this concept that back in the day where there were top marginal tax rates of 75%, the idea that if you lower them and inject capital into businesses, small businesses, entrepreneurs, that they can keep more of what they earn, that you'll grow the economy and ultimately have a larger, more expanded tax base, which is exactly what happened in the 1980s. But somehow that was perverted into this idea that is what George Herbert Walker Bush once described as voodoo economics, where the way to get more money in state revenues is to cut taxes. And what they discovered in Kansas is, through the regime of Sam Brownback, that sometimes when you cut taxes, you just get less money. And they had a lot less money and not enough money to run the vital services of government. And so you see a Democrat in there. You see the cost of extremism in American politics. And I thought Kansas fulfilling its historical space in this country is really a fault line.
And another vote, too, with the ballot measures. How many states voted for Medicaid expansion? Conservative states where the governors rejected it. But the people wanted it.
And then that's absolutely right. And also on that point and on Kansas, I think one of the other bright spots, and I'd love to end on a bright spot on this section, which is Kansas 3rd, which is a 94% urban district. You have a woman who was elected who's a Native American. She's a lesbian. She's the first of both of those to be elected to the United States Congress. And it looks like when you look at that map, it looks like Berlin sitting in the middle of a sea of, but it seems like it's slowly starting to turn that way.
Well, my tornado theory.
That's your tornado theory.
Well,
exactly.
Not my tornado theory, because I ripped it off from a smart strategist friend. But the tornadoes hit, and where they hit, they took out Donald Trump, and other places are completely unscathed. And that's kind of the landscape that we're looking at right now as we proceed onward.
Elise, that'll have to be the final word. And with the recounts continuing, this election truly won't be over till it's over. To be continued. Let's talk about our partner for a minute, Audible. I've been slowly converting Elise and Steve to Audible.
We want to thank our partner, Audible. If there's a book you like, and we read a lot of them around here, chances are you can find it on Audible.
You can choose three titles every month, one audiobook, and two Audible originals that you can't hear anywhere else. You can listen on any device, anytime, anywhere, at home, at the gym, or running errands, or on the subway.
We put out some important and relevant titles like Steve Kornacki's The Red and the Blue, Tom Ricks's Churchill and Orwell, Born Trump by Emily Jane Fox, Profiles in Courage by John F. Kennedy, and Columbine by Dave Cullen. All of those titles into the Words Matter library. And Steve, tell them about our Words Matter special offer.
Right now, for a limited time, you can get 3 months of Audible for just $6.95 a month. That's more than half off the regular price. So get yourself to listening. While you're at it, think about giving the gift of Audible to someone on your list. Go to audible.com/wordsmatter or text Words Matter to 500-500.
That's audible.com/wordsmatter or text Words Matter to 500-500.
Audible, because words matter.
That's right, Audible, because words matter.
Thank you for listening to Words Matter with Elise Jordan and Steve Schmidt. For more information on our show and hosts, visit wordsmattermedia.com. Please rate and review Words Matter on Apple Podcasts and other podcast providers.